for Iolorothi to hide. It would be the perfect place for us to begin our life together. The sun threatened to set, and it cast a deep and angry fire of red across the endless sky. This empty land was surrounded by mountains, but they squatted thousands of miles before me and looked like I could crush them in my hands. The desert floor was dried dirt tiles mixed with salt. They glittered in the red light of the dying sun, and for a few minutes it seemed as if I ran atop endless lava. An hour of jogging passed, and the last rays of the sun turned a soothing violet and then a deep purple. The color clashed with the green glow from the moon and gave the barren land a sickly hue. Up ahead I spotted a gang of lizards feasting on the corpse of a fallen one of their own kind. I picked up speed and outpaced the wind past them. The creatures were the size of a small pony, covered in spiky scales. Their maws opened wide enough to swallow an adult wolf. I killed a few yesterday, but their flesh tasted horrible. It was tough and filled with bones. Soon I would be at Dead Flats and could get a real meal. Thoughts of food made me think of water. I grabbed at my last skin and drank a quarter of its contents while my feet continued their forward momentum. Before the salt desert, I traveled through hundreds of miles of hilly badlands. Food was almost never a concern for me, since I easily killed whatever I happened by, but water was scarce, and I could only go a few weeks without it. The water from my skin poured warm, but it tasted delicious. I had planned on saving some just in case the city somehow did not have a water supply. I reasoned that it was only a few more hours of travel, and if water was not a traded commodity in Dead Flats, then life certainly would be. So I drained the rest of the bladder and picked up my pace. There were no trees in the endless wasteland, so the wind had an unfettered path to scream across the desert. Most normal humans would need to duck low in an attempt to crawl under the overwhelming gusts. Even most O'Barney would have found the intense gales hard to cope with and might have thought about setting up camp for the night. But most O'Barney only harnessed power from the earth. They used the magic to fuel their bodies, make them stronger, faster, and heighten their senses. O'Barney, who were more skilled, could unleash the earth externally and combine it with wind to create fire. I had learned to harness all of the elements. I had mastered water during the last battle between the humans and elvens. Iolorothi had unleashed a surprise attack with three indomitable dragons who were decimating our forces with ease. By pulling the energy out of water, I had defeated one of the dragons, ripping all the moisture from its massive alien body. Then I quickly learned how to pull fire and wind when his sire blasted me with a spray of liquid magma from an angry maw. I defeated him as well. The last remaining dragon, the female Riccato Lusti Catri, escaped, flinging me from her talon in mid-flight and sentencing me to death for murdering her mate and child. Except I did not die. Iolorothi found me. We had made love and were discovered by Shlara. I forced the painful memories out of my head. I had not thought about that day for many months, but it refused to be bottled up and discarded. The ordeal had taught me how to pull power from all of the elements. The wind that tried to thwart me on this salty plain was quickly harnessed into me and used to fuel my body. I still did not know why Entis refused to teach us about the other elements. He had not seemed surprised or angry when I showed him that I had learned how to pull from water. He only cautioned me against using it and forbade me from asking him about it. The other elements felt different from Earth. Earth was slow, consistent, and familiar. It felt as easy and soothing as the beating of my heart. Water and wind felt chaotic inside of me. They tried to force their way out like blood gushing through a thousand tiny lacerations. Fire was intense pressure, screaming for release, a breath held too long. I had plenty of time to practice using them now. There was no army to manage, no people to train, no enemy to crush under my boot. I only wanted to find Iola Rothi and continue to grow in strength and power. I began to perceive a faint orange glow across the emptiness. My vision was as keen as an eagle's, and I guessed there were another 40 miles ahead of me before I would reach the outskirts of the town. I had chased Iola Rothi for so many years now, it was hard to remember my life before this. The years had been spent in solitude, which did strange things to my perception of time. I did not actually know how much time had passed since I killed Shlara. I did not want to know. Iola Rothi remained a few steps ahead of me. Sometimes I missed her by months, sometimes by days. Once I saw her on a distant mountain range. The sight had energized me, and I pushed myself to catch up to her. When I reached the spot where she had been, I found nothing but a few scattered footprints and the smoking embers of a hastily abandoned campfire. Somehow she had eluded me, and I never glimpsed her again. But she left a trail. She was not simply evading me, she was searching for something. At first I believed it was for the remnants of her people, but the longer I tracked her, the more I came to realize she was seeking something more. The Obarni destroyed most of the elven estates in our quest to annihilate their race. We had not even wanted to inhabit the same grounds as our enemies. The very buildings they had erected were tributes to the centuries of our oppression, and they were as important to destroy as the oppressors themselves. Iola Rothi was searching for the remaining places that had not been razed by the Obarni. I had not figured out why she was in Dead Flats, but I would have answers soon. I slowed my pace a few miles from the city. I could not draw attention to myself with a superhuman approach, and I wanted to take in the view of the bizarre metropolis. Long ago, something massive had fallen from the sky and landed in the center of the salt desert. Whatever had collided into the planet had destroyed 3,000 square miles of land. There was nothing to be found here but salt and gemstones, and survivors scraping by through grit and stubbornness. At the center of where I imagined the collision to have occurred rose a large, flat-topped hill. The mass must have been pushed upward by the impact, and it only added to my belief that whatever hit the planet had been significant in size. The mesa was about 5 miles long and a third of a mile high. Wind had slowly eroded the top of the hill to its level tabletop after thousands of years. The city was situated at the base of the mesa. An incongruously sturdy-looking gate hung against wood stakes tied together by rusted barbed wire. Torches burned at the top of the posts, sputtering against the wind. Past the gates, squat, simple wooden structures were augmented by rough patches of stonework. The salty streets branched out from the gate as limbs of a tree, the farthest-reaching dwellings carved out of a low-lying hill. Most of the homes were dark at this hour, but a few had torches or fireplaces lit, a warm pink glow visible through their windows. It looked as if half of the hillside was home to a nest of resting fireflies. I was spotted when I was an eighth of a mile from the front gate. 2 men rode out on horseback. I wondered how they fed their animals, or themselves for that matter, as no crops would grow on these badlands. Then I wondered how they even got the wood for their homes. Finally, I asked myself how anyone could even think to live out in this forsaken land. It did not matter. I let my curiosity lie and directed my focus back to my mission. "What is your business?" one of the men on horseback inquired. They wore dusty leather pants and long coats of gray wool. Their faces were dry and more weathered than the side of the hill. "Looking for dead flats, is this it?" I asked the obvious question. "Yeah. You travel in the night?" the other man asked with worry. His mount shifted sideways nervously. I recalled the various black and ill-tempered horses I rode during my life. The head of his horse would not have even reached halfway up the body of one of my steeds. "Is there a place to get food and water?" I asked with a faked gasp. Hopefully they would think I was in distress, weak, and not a threat. The gusts of wind had died down to a breeze, so we could hear each other. The location of the city, in relation to the hill, must have been planned to reduce the effects of the wind. "Are you diseased?" one of the men pointed to his face, and I realized I still had my head wrapped in cloth. "No, just keeping the sun and salt out." I unwrapped my head and showed them my face. I had decided to let my beard and hair grow long, but it would not fool anyone who knew me. "About that food?" "Down the main avenue, first right, left side, Lizard Breath Inn. What is your business here?" The first man beckoned me to follow him toward the gate and the light of the torches on the fence posts. "Meeting a friend. Rock business." Rock could be taken to mean either gems or salt. That was the only reason people came here, to mine or to trade. The men nodded and opened the gate to let me pass. For a second, the two exchanged glances, and I thought they would try to extort me, but the second passed, and they closed the gate without another word. Only the creak of the salt-crusted hinges marked my passage. The road was made of dried, crusted mud, but the wood homes lining the street had stone foundations built up out of the dirt. The light from the sputtering torches lining the street reflected off the salt coating the ground and the houses, making everything sparkle. I heard heartbeats and gentle breathing inside of each home, and I imagined that most citizens here were getting as much rest as they could before waking up early to dig in the mines. I had never worked in a mine, but had freed many people who had slaved in them under the Elvens. While all of us had suffered as slaves, those men and women had a dead look in their eyes that was unchanged by freedom. They had lost themselves somewhere in the dark depths of the earth. They were very effective in my army. I heard the voices and laughter of the Lizard Breath Inn before I saw the place. The building was two stories high and not at all stable. The corners were made of stacked, roughly hewn stones. One side was a little uneven, and it caused the inn to lean. A salt-speckled post extended from the mud on that side in some futile attempt to prop up the structure in case the wind decided to change direction. I pushed through a set of thin wooden doors to enter the lobby of the inn. The hinges squealed loudly, announcing my entrance and causing the conversations to halt as the patrons looked up at me. I took a few steps on a threadbare, salt-covered rug while I memorized the position of everyone in the room, their size, and if they were a threat. None were. A fat old man sitting by the door stopped me. "No weapons." He pointed at my spear and then thumbed toward a table where a few small picks, a bare, rusty short sword, and various clubs were piled in a heap. I nodded at the man, leaned my weapon against the wood, and walked across the room to the long bar that separated what I guessed was the innkeeper and his daughter from the rest of the patrons. "You're new." The innkeeper may have been the son of the man by the door. He looked very similar, only 30 pounds lighter and greasier. I sat on a surprisingly sturdy stool and sighed in an attempt at weariness. "Been traveling for a long time, from the Green Mountains. Water?" I shrugged off my pack and set it on the ground next to me. "Metal?" He shot his daughter an angry glare when she tried to fill my request. His look stopped her like an arrow through a rabbit's heart. "What will you take?" The Elvens had traded in various forms of metal and artwork. It made sense to keep some traditions. Water is free with food. He nodded at the girl, and she quickly filled up the cup that had been dangling in between her fingers. What are you serving? I'll need a room as well. I noticed that the conversations behind me resumed. Lizard steaks with mushrooms. Also have fish stew. Rooms are an iron piece a night. Two meals are included with water. Anything else, and you have to pay extra. He peered at his daughter with an evil smirk. She hastily turned away and made busy with cleaning what looked like the only pair of glasses left in the place. I now assumed that she probably wasn't his daughter, or he was a really sick fucker. I'll take a room for 3 nights. The stew now. Where do you get the fish from? I knew the lizard meat to be repulsive, but I was also a bit put off by the idea of how fish got to a desert. I rummaged through the inside of my pack to where I carried a few pouches of various solid blocks of metal. I could twist the earth and pull off a piece of whatever I wanted easily. On my second attempt, my fingers recognized iron, and I pulled off what felt like the right amount. The river. He said it as if I asked what color the moon was. Ah, yeah. They said one runs under the city. I handed my 3 iron pieces across the table to him. They were each about the size of my thumbnail. He looked hungrily at them and put them in a pocket of his dirty apron. I had guessed the right size. First time in Dead Flats, eh? Yeah. I drained the cup of water in a single swallow. It was surprisingly cool, and I didn't taste any salt. What brings you here, kid? Trade? Mining? Adventure? I smiled through the lie. How about that stew? The man looked over to the girl and barked a name I couldn't understand. She set down the glasses and scurried into the kitchen. When she returned, 2 of the men playing stones bid their friends a good night and left the inn. I noticed the bartender watch them leave with a frown. "Something wrong?" I said, before I swallowed the next cup of water. "Nah," he smirked at me and poured a foul-smelling potato-based alcohol into a mug. Then he drank it as quickly as I had swallowed the water. The girl came out with a steaming bowl that didn't smell as fishy as I expected. She set it in front of me with a shy smile and scurried to the far side of the bar. She would have been pretty if she had not grown up under such harsh conditions. Life had not improved for everyone, even with our enslavers gone. I had other things to worry about. I expected the stew to be salty, and it was, but the flavor did not overpower my tongue. The fish tasted fresh, and it was mixed in an orange-colored cream sauce with spicy mushrooms, dense potatoes, and some sort of green vegetable that tasted sweeter than carrots. I hadn't eaten in a few days, but I wasn't famished, and slowly savored the meal. When I roamed the wilderness, I didn't have to worry about food. I could put my spear through the heart of a boar from 500 feet away, stalk prey with the stealth of a mountain cat, and run faster than most horses. I just had to find Iola Rothi and avoid anyone sent after me. I heard Schlara scream again. It echoed in my brain hundreds of times. I saw her body bend backward as the sticky fire enveloped her. I smelled the scent of her flesh burning. "You all right, kid? Looked like you were about to puke." "Most like the stew," the innkeeper's words pulled me back from the distressing thoughts. "I'm fine. Can I have another bowl?" I hastily scooped up the last 2 bites and raised an eyebrow. "You're supposed to get only 1 bowl per meal." The door to the inn opened, and several pairs of boots entered. The innkeeper's oily skin turned the color of piss, and he wrung his hands on his apron. "I'll get you another, though, since you are new in town." He scurried back through the doors to the kitchen. For a second, I assumed the men who had entered were the local law enforcement, or town bullies, as was usually the case. I had run into a few of these types in my travels. Most of the time I could talk my way out of whatever conflict they had concocted as an excuse to fight or detain me. Others had to be paid off. Twice I had killed them when we failed to come to an agreement. I knew from their footsteps that these were not mere humans. I felt the wind displace from the room with their bulky frames. Their steps were careful, calculated and smooth. No, these were my kin, and I cursed myself for having journeyed to Dead Flats. They must have suspected that I would eventually get here. They must have guessed that this town, past the edge of whatever civilization they were trying to build, would be a tempting sanctuary to a traitor. There were four of them. Two took seats next to me at the bar to my right. The other pair sat on my left. I steadied my heartbeat and breathing. Maybe they wouldn't know who I was through the beard. Only the highest-ranked soldiers and generals knew what I looked like. The rest only recognized my armor and my name. The girl saw them take a seat and practically ran into the back room. "Round of drinks, Toss," the man to my left yelled. The doors to the kitchen opened, and the innkeeper emerged with another bowl of stew for me. He set it in front of me with a nervous flick and grabbed four wooden cups and filled them with the vile potato brew from the barrel. "You knew?" the man to my right asked when I took my first spoonful of the new bowl. I chewed slowly and glanced over at him before answering. He looked just like his companion, muscular, with a shaved head, thick jaw, and hands crisscrossed in countless scars. Just like mine. These were Thayer's men. "Yeah, I'm not looking for trouble. Maybe I can buy your next round?" I licked my lips nervously, and it was not a bluff. My spear was on the other side of the room. They were not armed, but it would not matter. Thayer's troops had been my heavy infantry and could defeat any other soldier in my army 9 times out of 10. They were hard men and women and took the bare banner of Thayer very seriously. "What is your name?" the man to my left said. He was the biggest of the four, and he looked like he shaved his face and head with a wood saw. "You haven't even bought me a drink yet," I smiled. The conversations in the inn had all stopped, and the patrons were watching the scene unfold at the bar. Luckily, I didn't recognize the four men, and they wore no armor. They were clothed in salt-covered gray working attire. Perhaps they were here for some other purpose than to find me. "Do I look like I have a sense of humor?" Sawface gave me a dead stare. I raised my hands. "Leotol is my name. I had never told anyone about my brother, or my father, or Iolarothi. The name was safe." Sawface stared at me for a few seconds, and then turned back to his drink without a word. The warrior behind him sniffed and looked down at his cup as well. It seemed like the situation had relaxed, so I turned to my fish stew and returned to eating. I had only taken a few bites before the man on my right spoke again. "You came in at night." It wasn't a question, but I took it as one. "Yeah. The guards at the gate say you didn't have a torch." He looked at me, but I concentrated on my next bite of food. Moon was bright. Didn't need one. I focused on relaxing. "Can I have another cup of water?" I asked the greasy innkeeper. He was poking his head out from behind the doors to the kitchen. "You have torches in your bag, then?" "Fuck." "Of course," I smiled at the man. "What is this about? Can't I eat in peace?" The innkeeper took my cup and filled it with shaking hands. I heard his heart pounding like a rabbit's. I wondered what he knew about me, the O'Barney, or if he only knew these men were here to find someone wandering alone. "We are looking for someone. Someone like you," Sawface said with a grimace that made him look even uglier. "Someone eating fish stew in a broken-down inn at the end of the world?" Sawface still didn't laugh. I should have attacked. It would have given me a slight edge that might have helped me get out of this alive. someone who fits your description. Long hair, beard, body of an Obarni, traveling alone and doesn't identify himself to his kin. Someone that doesn't want to be found. Sawface carefully set his cup down on the bar. What if I am not the man you are looking for? No one comes to this town unless they are running. Only one man would be here. He stared at me and gritted his teeth. Kyair. The four men stood up from their stools at the mention of my name. I took another bite of my stew. It was halfway eaten, but I pushed the bowl away and wiped the side of my mouth and beard with the back of my sleeve. If you really thought I was Kyair, you would have brought more than four of you. I turned to look at Sawface. Our eyes made contact, and I stared into his pupils. I saw into their depths and his soul. I saw his fear and his doubt. He was a hard man. They all were. But I was a legend. I created them. I alone had slain two of the dragons that almost annihilated my army. I wore the tortured demon armor that gave our enemies nightmares. Don't make this difficult on us, sir. His face broke and revealed the terror in his eyes. You can turn and walk away. Let me continue on my path. I slid off of my chair, and the four men took a small step back. We have our orders. Come with us peacefully, please. But his voice did not plead. It was resolute. He was one of Thayer's, after all. A few of the patrons, sitting at their tables, stared in mute horror. I guessed they wanted to leave the inn, but I imagined they were so paralyzed by fear that they couldn't move their legs, or perhaps they didn't want to bring attention to themselves. If I surrender, what is the plan? I glanced around at the four warriors, and then to Sawface. We'll take you to primary camp. Then what will happen? I smiled. I am not privy to such information, sir. We are tasked with bringing you there. Primary camp is at least a month and a half travel from here. How are you going to prevent me from escaping during the journey? You taught Thayer. He taught our leaders. We will do what is necessary to bring you back, sir. They stood comfortably, but their hearts began to beat quicker. They were prepared to fight me. At one point, I knew everyone in my army. There were only a few thousand, and I always had a good memory. But when we swelled in size, it became too difficult to remember everyone. I wanted to know the names of these men. This assignment had to be difficult. If they succeeded, they would spend the rest of their lives thinking about this moment when they had apprehended the man who had destroyed their enemies, freed their people, and betrayed all of their values within the same hour. But if I knew their names, it would be that much harder to kill them. The right side of my forehead connected with Sawface's nose and shattered his skull like a cracked egg. I didn't think the headbutt would harm his brain and kill him, but I hoped it would. The blow would at least do enough damage to keep him out of the battle for 5 minutes. In a fight with the Obarni, 5 minutes was enough time to do plenty of damage. Sawface tried to step away, but he either didn't actually expect me to attack him, or he didn't realize I could move as fast as I did. My blow sent him spinning across the inn, scattering the salt-worn tables, breaking the flimsy chairs, and smashing dozens of half-empty glasses. I moved my left arm up automatically, and blocked the jab that the warrior on that side intended for my face. Our limbs collided with a sharp slapping sound and resonated like two blocks of wood slamming together. Then I twisted my body to the right and dodged the committed front kick that the man in the center of the group had aimed at my hips. I threw out my knee and caught the side of his thigh while my right hand slid across his chest, up to his neck, and forced his chin up to the sky. The momentum he put into his kick and the way I adjusted his torso made him lose his balance. I pulled back on my arm and helped his upper body slam into the dirty floor of the inn. The wood cracked into hundreds of pieces upon impact. Or maybe it only sounded that way because, at the same time, the third man's sidekick hit me square in the chest and broke half of my ribs. The blow launched me backward in the air, through the wooden wall of the inn, and out into the salt-covered street. I rolled four times before I came to my feet. My ribs had already healed, but the hole my flying body left in the side of the dilapidated structure was a critical injury. The leaning building began to moan a sigh of death, and I saw it tilt dangerously. I ran north, through the dark streets of the city, and toward the cropped mountain. I didn't have a plan beyond escaping Thayer's men, but I figured if I bought myself a few minutes to think, I would come up with something. As soon as I made it half a mile up the main street, I jumped up into the hayloft of a stable to assess my surroundings. I didn't hear my pursuers, but that didn't mean they had given up their chase. I did hear the sounds of the lizard breaths in collapsing and the final screams of the patrons trapped inside. Now I wondered if Iolorothi had ever been in Dead Flats. If Thayer's men were stationed here, waiting for me, they would have noticed her. She had probably realized this, avoided the town, and moved on. If I lost her trail now, it would mean another year or more of lost time. One of the men sprinted down the street faster than a horse and skidded to a stop. I ducked back into the shadows, away from the window, but it did not matter. They could hear me, smell me, and track me now that they knew me. I was trapped. I remembered the underground river. It was a desperate move, but it was the only choice I had to avoid killing Thayer's men. I could hold my breath for 10, maybe 15 minutes. I could lose them in the current and let the water take me away. I just needed to find the river. The man below whistled, and I recognized it as a signal that he had found me. I turned to dash across the loft, but two of the warriors crashed through the roof above me. The impact of their heavy landing on the hayloft crushed the thin wood planks, and I leapt out through the wall of the barn behind me. It crumbled as if it were made of brittle paper. I flipped over in midair and landed on my feet on the road below. The warriors on the street ducked low and swooped beneath me in an attempt to knock me down and wrestle me on the ground. His right shoulder contacted my right hip. He lifted and slammed me into the mud. I snaked my arm under his chin as we fell and wrapped my left leg over his so that he could not shake loose to gain a better position. He fought my chokehold, but his was an inexperienced move, and I took advantage of it by tilting my upper body, forcing my legs down, which put his neck into an acute angle that cut off his air. I felt his lungs fight and suck against nothing. It would take 10 minutes to choke an O'Barney into unconsciousness, and I did not have that much time. I had 5 seconds or less before the other two men would emerge from the ruins of the barn to assist their fellow warrior. He continued to pull and fight against my choke. I pulled him tighter and then pushed back as he fought against me. The sudden release of his head sent him spinning away from me, and I aided his travel with a kick to his chest. I rolled to my feet in time to almost block a punch from one of the other men. His right fist slammed my nose into hundreds of fragments. His left hand came around in a hook that I dodged by half an inch as I stumbled away from him. He pressed his attack, throwing 2 jabs with his right hand and a short uppercut with his left. I knocked the jabs away, but the uppercut was unexpected, and it caught me in the stomach. The pain was remote, though, and by the time he threw his next rounds of attacks, I had healed from the broken nose and managed to parry them. I heard the other warrior from the stable run up from behind me. The man who had tried to grapple with me rose. I backed away to keep them from circling me. Once I got a few feet of space between us, I sprung up and backward to land on the rickety roof of a home nearby. I ran across it and jumped just before the roof collapsed. I landed on the side street behind, slipped in some of the mud there, and dashed around the corner away from the warriors. But they were on me instantly and kept within 5 feet as I ran westward through the city. I would not be able to lose them without taking drastic measures. I gathered the earth to me and pivoted. The power released through me in the form of air. I added a spark of earth, and the magic erupted in a blaze of green and anger. My pursuers jumped to the side in a frantic attempt to escape oblivion. Two of them were successful, but the one closest to me moved too slowly. His death scream cut through the air of the city for only a brief flash before his body turned into ash and scattered. The fire continued another 500 feet away from me, devouring half a dozen homes and the innocent people sleeping within. Then the flame crashed into the flank of the hill and bounced upward toward the stars. Every surface in the city was covered in crystallized salt, and for a moment, dead flats shone brighter than the moon. My torso bent to the side, and my breath exploded out of my lungs. Sawface had slammed me to the ground on my back with a jump kick that would have snapped an oak tree in half. He was instantly on top of me, but I managed to buck my hips and dislodge him from gaining a favorable position where he could have pummeled me easily. The warrior grabbed onto my left arm and fell to the side next to me in the hardened mud of the street. He locked my wrist with both hands and spun his body around to leverage his hips against my elbow and break my arm. One of the remaining warriors crashed on my stomach with a knee that I was too preoccupied to avoid. It probably would have rendered most humans incoherent, and perhaps knocked out any of the Obarni, but I had a high tolerance for pain, and I registered the damage as if it had happened to someone else. As soon as he landed, my right hand came up in a knife's edge formation and struck his throat. The windpipe collapsed, and he gurgled out in agony. He was a better grappler than Sawface, and he squeezed his legs together around my hips when I tried to buck him off of me. The third attacker stepped from my right side and aimed a booted toe kick at my face. I brought up my right elbow and blocked the attack, but the kick carried so much momentum that I felt the impact register through my whole body, at the same time as Sawface's strength won out over my left arm. He bent it back against his leveraged hip lock and broke the elbow with a wet-sounding tear that sent a numb shock of alarm through my chest. The warrior that pinned me punched downward and connected with my nose. It broke again, and my sinus cavities filled with an explosion of blood. I tried to move my right arm away from the man kicking me to block the other warrior's next flurry of attacks, but I only got half of them. Each punch pushed my head into the mud a few inches, and my skull struggled not to break under the pressure. The warrior who tried to kick me must have grabbed my right arm. I felt it bend away as my vision blurred. Then my sight cleared before the man who had me pinned ducked down and drove his elbow into my temple. I was floating in darkness. Someone said my name, but I ignored it. I was safe here, alone. I had no worries, no cares, no guilt. The voice was insistent. I felt a hand rub my cheek. Then I heard my name being called again. I opened my eyes and saw her. Iola Rothi. She knelt over me, blocking out the moonlight and encasing her face in shadows. I had found her. Or, more appropriately, she had just found and saved me. Chapter 5. Kyair. Soldier, are you okay? I gasped when the man's words yanked me from my reverie. I looked around fearfully and couldn't remember where I stood or what I was doing. You look sick, boy. Maybe you should sit down or eat something. Maybe you should eat something while sitting down. My stomach flopped when I remembered that I was in Nadia's camp. I am fine. What were you saying? I tried to relax, but I couldn't. My brain had scattered like horses in a thunderstorm. The last time I had a memory that violent, I destroyed the east wing of Castle Naya. I was surprised and relieved that the men and women around me were unharmed. I said, "What's your name, soldier? I have to write it on the log in order for you to take possession of this here gear." The man was older, leathery, and had a smile missing a tooth from the bottom front array. His face reminded me of the trader's from my memory, and it must have been what triggered the sudden recollection. He was the quartermaster of Nadia's army. He pointed to a small pack and 5-foot spear that he retrieved from the back of the large tent. Kyer is my name. What unit and commander? He wrote in a thick logbook. I hesitated for a few moments, and he looked up from his writing. I am unsure. I don't have all day, son. Help me out here. Who do you report to? He sighed and wiped the sweat off of his oily brow. His hair thinned at the top, and it scattered the few strands across his forehead where they stuck like ivy on a wall. He had a slight accent that I was unfamiliar with, but that wasn't surprising, since I had only learned the language around a year ago. I don't really report to anyone. I think it would be Nadia. Sure you do, son. Every boy wants to report to the Duchess. I'm about ready to throw you out of here if you don't stop wasting my time. Annoyance coated his voice. A few other soldiers stood in the tent, waiting to procure equipment, and they chuckled at the quartermaster's words. Just write my name on the ledger and give me the equipment. Are you sure you don't have any sort of bow? I remembered him saying that they were all out of scout kits and only had infantry ones. A few other soldiers entered the tent behind me, but I didn't turn to look at them. No, I don't have a fucking bow, the man raised his voice to a shout, and I'm not going to give you anything unless your fucking commander rides his horse in here and threatens to cut off my head and feed it to the ancients, you fucking asshole. The man's face turned red, and a vein popped out on top of his balding forehead. That is enough, a man called out from behind me. I recognized the voice, but the rest of the men in the room turned around quickly and saluted. Sorry, sir, the quartermaster grimaced in pain. I am surprised you did not recognize this man's name, or did you not pay attention? Danor stepped next to me. I had never asked his rank during our escapades into the sewers of Castle Naya, but it appeared he carried some clout. I am sorry, sir, the quartermaster said again with fear. Give Kyer what he needs, Danor said with a sigh. The older man nodded before he passed the spear and pack over the wooden table that separated his workspace from the rest of the tent. I still don't have a bow, sir. My apologies. I'll find him one. Danor turned to me. His mustachio was a bit longer than I remembered, and there were streaks of gray in it. Join me for dinner? Of course. I smiled at him and threw the pack over my shoulder. I nodded to the quartermaster and walked out of the tent. The other soldiers parted to let us pass. I followed him for a few steps outside the logistics tent before he turned to face me and gave me a light punch on the shoulder. Where have you been? I haven't seen you around the camp in the last few weeks. I even checked your tent a few times. His face transformed, and he gave me a crooked smirk. I've been watching over Nadia, he nodded, and then pointed toward the mess pavilion, and we continued to walk beside each other. Rumor is that she is recovered. He raised an eyebrow at me. Yes, I couldn't help my smile. Excellent. Our Duchess is too stubborn to die. He laughed and then gestured at the opening to the mess tent a few hundred yards up the face of the twisty gorge wall. They are serving tasteless gruel mixed with 2-week-old half-rotten venison. If you don't get heartburn, you'll probably vomit. He smiled knowingly at me, but I have something to wash it down with. He pulled a bottle from a pouch on his belt. Dark amber liquid swirled inside the thick glass. Sounds good to me, I said. We hiked our way up the side of the gorge, and then climbed up a series of sturdy ladders to reach the mess pavilion. Inside were benches for about 30 people, and most of them were occupied. A few men and women looked up to see who had entered, but no one saluted. There was a line at the back of the tent where cooks scooped the gray and green slop into bowls for those waiting. The room reeked of sweat and the starchy warm smell of the gruel, which did little to mask the rancid stink of the meat. Danor and I didn't speak until we had sat down with our food. The cooks had divvied out a small scoop of the oatmeal and venison mixture, along with a slightly larger scoop of what possibly had been spinach, but was now steamed beyond recognition. "Beats hard rations. At least it is warm and wet." Danor fished out the bottle of alcohol and took a short sip before passing it to me. A few of the other soldiers at the table shot him a sidelong glance and then looked down at their food. The fluid was a rice and rye mixture. It tasted pleasantly sweet, with enough bitter heat at the end to remind my tongue of the alcohol. "Perhaps I should have been harder on the quartermaster." Danor took another bite and grimaced. The food tasted horrible, but the drink washed it down in a fiery inferno. Wasn't much point, though. No use getting people more excited or upset than they already are. I agree. I wasn't going to make a fuss. I figured I could live off of the land without any weapons. I've done so before. The memory of running across the salt desert entered my mind. "Why would you need to live off of the land?" Danor passed me back the bottle after he took a swig. We sat shoulder to shoulder with other soldiers, but there was enough whispered talk at the table to keep our conversation private. "I will be heading north." "That seems like a terrible idea." Danor shook his head and then choked on a bite of steamed green mash. "Safer than eating this food, I think," I said with a smile that he returned. "Fair enough. I figure you have your reasons for doing something crazy like taking on the Empress's army alone." He frowned for a second, and then suddenly seemed to remember something. "Hey, I never thanked you for saving my life a few months ago when we ran through the dungeons." "It was nothing, friend," I said with a shrug. "No, it was something. I have never been so terrified. I thought I would die down there half a dozen times, and I would have if not for you. You also helped us get out of the castle with Nadia. I didn't see you kill the ancients the night of the banquet, but I heard the stories about you." He nodded, and I noticed that some of the surrounding soldiers had stopped talking and listened to what Danor said. "You were the one that found me running lost through the halls with Nadia over my shoulder. I think I would still be there if you and Rumir hadn't led me out." I took another bite and realized that the gruel was actually starting to taste better. The mixture was probably annihilating my taste buds past the point where I might heal them. "Well, as a reward, you can have the rest of my grub. If you can figure out how to get those worms out of my nightmares, I'll even offer you a bonus plate." Danor chuckled and pushed his tray away half-eaten. I laughed with him, but didn't take him up on the offer. After another minute, I pushed back my own tray and washed the scum in my mouth out with the rest of the liquid from his bottle. "Looks like I finished it." "Eh, it isn't mine. I stole it from Graykin. He was sleeping in Jesme's room during our mission and had a stash there. He'll get angry at you for drinking all of it." The mustached man smiled again and made a half-serious attempt at a salute. "I'll have to make it up to him. I hoped the old bear was still alive." "Some of the other officers play a few games of gamble every night. If you want to come join us, we might have a few bottles of wine." Danor got out of his seat and grabbed his dirty tray, gesturing for me to follow. We set them in a bin on our way out. "Thank you for the offer, but I have a few tasks to attend to before I leave." He nodded and then turned around to survey the camp. The angle of the late-day sun created deep shadows that clothed the sides of the cliff walls in dark purple. "I hate long goodbyes. I'll have someone swing by your tent and drop off a bow." "Thank you," I said gratefully. "Be safe, Kyair. I'd like to eat some real food with you someday. He turned to me, held his hand out, and smiled when I grasped his palm. I'd enjoy that, Danor. Be safe as well. He nodded and walked away without another word. I stared at his back for a few moments and realized that I had more friends in this life than I thought I did. Runeir had procured a tiny tent for me about 500 yards north of Nadia's. It had enough room for a small cot, a chest, and a chair. The top of the chest closed flat and could double as a desk of sorts. Runeir told me that they had several backup stores of supplies concealed across the nation of Naya just in case a traveling unit might need to restock. They probably never imagined that they would have to support an army of a few thousand with these caches. I laid my new pack on the top of the chest and inspected the spear for a minute. It wasn't a piece of artwork, but the leaf-shaped blade would be sufficient. Inside the bag were about 2 weeks' worth of food that would keep well, flatbread, dried beans, a bag of salt, and a small leather skin of lime juice. I'd be able to kill what I needed out in the forest, and my enemies would have food I could plunder from their corpses. The pack also contained 3 water skins, a hatchet, knife, wax tinder, a few sheets of oiled canvas for tent-making, and a bedroll. By the time I finished inspecting all the equipment, the sun had set, and the campsite was encased in darkness. Night was treacherous in Fisherman's Gorge. We couldn't light torches on the upper levels for fear of the camp being discovered, so the soldiers moved their training and meals down to the cramped space next to the creek. Lantern-bearers stationed themselves at pivotal points on the walkways to give brief flashes of illumination to guide people across the narrow cliffs. I could see in almost absolute darkness, so the lack of light didn't bother me, but I imagined that most of the warriors just stayed in their tents at night. "Kyair?" Nadia's voice called softly from outside. I had heard footsteps approach, but my tent sat by a major stairway, and there were always footsteps moving past me. "Enter," I said, as I set my pack on top of the chest. She wore a hooded cloak and carried a short bow and quiver in her arms. "Knight Captain Danor left this with my guards for me to bring to you." She shook her head, and the hood fell back away from her hair. There was an inkling of the twin moon's glow. It came through my tent and gave a sheen to her smooth brown hair. "Thank you." I took the weapon from her and inspected its condition. The pull was set much too light, even for a normal human, but I'd make it work. While I looked at the bow, she took off her cloak, laid it over the back of my only chair, and then sat down with her legs crossed. "What is a knight captain?" I asked her after I finished. "A captain rank, same as Runeir, but he has also been knighted by the king, as you have." Her eyes stared into mine without blinking. I thought about asking her why Danor had been knighted, but I figured that someday he could tell me the story himself. "I am leaving in the morning," I said preemptively. "I'd prefer you wait," she replied with a rehearsed ease and a smile that made my eyes wander to her lips. "You don't have much use for me here." "I have plenty of uses for you imagined. Will you sit down, please?" She gestured at my cot, and I did so without thinking. I opened my mouth to reply, but she interrupted me. "I love my father, Jesme and Graykin. I want nothing more than to have them back safe here. If our situations were reversed and my father was talking to you here right now, well," she shook her head, "you two probably wouldn't even have this discussion. You'd both be on the road heading to Meriem, and you would be worried about keeping him alive." "You are right about that," I laughed and thought about Beltor's direct personality. I liked Nadia's father tremendously, and easily imagined him asking me to accompany him on a quest to rescue her. In fact, he had at one point. but it is not me that is lost at the moment. I have a place and a purpose. I also have safety here, especially with you by my side." Laughter drifted to us from a distant place in the gorge, and she stopped talking to take notice. "I'm still not used to this." She pointed to her ears and then laughed. "Or my sense of smell and vision. I can see for miles. I can make out fish at the bottom of the creek. It is incredible." I smiled at her momentary lapse in attention. "You have learned it very quickly. Most need months of practice to be able to focus their senses enough to be walking around in a crowded campsite." "I had a good teacher." She smiled at me. "That is another reason why I want you here. You know how to manage an army under the Obarni. You saw him lead our kind to victory against the ancients. Do you remember more that will help us? We need those strategies." She paused to let me speak. "It has been almost 9 months since we spoke about my memories." I closed my eyes and sighed. "I don't know how much I can help the army here. Even if I could help, I disagree that I need to be here." "Why?" Anger crept into her voice, but I guessed she expected me to fight her. "You've beat them before." I nodded. "You know how to beat them. You've seen the Obarni's army lay waste to them. You told me you were his general. What else do you remember?" Her words came quickly. "I wasn't the Obarni's general, Nadia. The Obarni was not a person. It was the name we gave ourselves. All of us. The humans like me and you, who were changed and had learned how to harness the elements. It means the ancients in our old language, a language even older than the one the Elvens and I share." Nadia stared at me in confusion, but I continued before she spoke. "Islata told me that the Elvens are calling themselves the Ancients because of the way this world has confused our legends. In fact, this isn't even the world I was born on. My world had a single green moon. Your world has two." "Your world has one moon? How?" "There are ways to travel between worlds. I believe that the Ancients created them. I remember speaking to an elder Elven. He was so old that he looked to be made of stone. He attended to some sort of shrine that could move people between the worlds. These shrines had stone tables in them, similar to the one where you found me. A different world? Would it look the same as ours? Have the same people? Same names?" I couldn't tell if she believed me, but she seemed to consider my words. "Different people. Different land masses and moons. I think the only thing they would have in common is that someone put these shrines on them, and that Elvens and our kind can live on them." "That would explain how the ancients returned here." Nadia nodded to herself. "They may have never been here. That also somewhat explains me." She stared off away from me briefly. "Explains you?" "Runeer told me that you know about my secret." I nodded, and she continued. "My mother, or I should say, my father's wife, she died giving birth to their child. He was insane with grief. Whenever he speaks of her, I can tell how much he loves her still." She smiled sadly. I could empathize with Beltor. "He told me that he rode to the teeth to get away from his sadness. He said he wanted to meditate about their love, but I always suspected he meant to get lost up there in the mountains and perish. He did get lost for many days. Then he heard the sound of a baby crying. The sound came from a strange-looking shrine. He found me lying on a stone dais. I was maybe a month old. No one was near me. It didn't look like anyone had ever set foot in the shrine." I nodded during her story. "Someone sent you through. I believe the shrines are called radicals, and they are powered by magical globes called ovules." I recalled the memories again. "Those are parts of a plant. I studied them when I was younger. Her statement made me realize that most of the words Pog had taught me for plants were very similar to the ones I already knew. I didn't understand our old language very well, but I suddenly suspected that there might be a link in the linguistics. What happened after Beltor found you? He took me home, she said. I didn't know that I was not his child.